You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 104. The scariest moment is always just before the start. Anonymous.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. Now, guys, today on the show, we have best-selling author and screenwriter Eileen Cook. She is a multi-published award-winning author, with her novels appearing in 9 languages. Her books have also been optioned for film and TV. Her best-selling book, Creating Story Conflict, is a must for screenwriters. And I really wanted to have her come on the show to break down how to create conflict with your story and your characters, because without conflict, you have no story. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Eileen Cook. I'd like to welcome to the show Eileen Cook. How are you doing, Eileen?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it. You are calling us from the Great White North, which is an envious place nowadays, apparently.
Safely over the border. We're building our own wall. We're doing good.
Safe. You know, it's for multiple reasons, it's a very envious place to be currently in the world as we speak here today. But we're here today to talk about writing and helping some screenwriters understand conflict specifically. You wrote a great book about conflict. So can you give me the definition of what conflict is in your point of view?
Sure. Conflict's friction at its most elemental level. And I should probably tell people like where I come from and sort of start out with is I'm a counselor by trade. That was my day job before I turned to writing full time. And so conflict is the bread and butter of why you have a counseling trade. If people don't have conflict and problems, then they're not coming to see counselors, and we don't make a living. So that's never a good thing. So conflict is friction. It's standing between you and whatever it is that you want. And you have to figure out some way to get through that friction. And in terms of any kind of book or screenplay, it's what keeps people watching. At its most basic level, just think of, remember when you used to go to coffee shops? Go back in time.
Oh, yeah, years ago.
Years ago, right? You would go to a coffee shop and, you know, what's more interesting? Sitting next to somebody just calmly reading their book or writing their screenplay on their laptop, or a couple having a fight? Like, you're interested in the couple having a fight. That's the people you're eavesdropping on.
But let me ask you a question though. So, my wife's a counselor as well. So I have a little bit of understanding, just the same way she has a little understanding about what green screen is. I have a little understanding about what she does. What is it in our psyche that is drawn to conflict on just an evolutionary standpoint? Cause you're absolutely right. Like, it's much more interesting to watch, you know, Breaking Bad than about him becoming a meth dealer than him teaching.
It wouldn't be a good show, really, if it was like I got up and I had a great day.
So what is that thing inside of us on a almost a reptilian, you know, in the back of our reptilian brain that causes us to be attracted to conflict?
I think it's partly because conflict is partly how we make change. So when you even say, you know, the term evolutionary, so if you're going to go beyond where you are, you have to stretch yourself. You have to do something different. So let's take a basic example of you want to learn to run. So if you're going to learn to, God knows why, but let's say you decide to take up jogging. If you're going to do that, you know, the first few days that you're going out, it's hard. You have to push through that. There's friction, right? It's staying in bed is more comfortable. You have to push through that in order to evolve into a writer. If you're wanting to write a screenplay, you know, everybody knows that feeling when you're sitting down in front of the screen and the cursor blink, blink, blink. And it's easier to turn it off, but you have to push through that in order to actually end up with words on the page and hopefully an eventual screenplay. So change is intrinsically linked to conflict. And when we talk about character arcs and wanting to see characters change over a story, they have to usually go through something in order to make that change. They're put to the test, to the metal. There's that saying, you never really know anyone until, you know, kind of the shit hits the fan idea, is that when we put people under pressure, they either move forward and evolve, or they retreat or they break.
So on a almost voyeuristic standpoint, we're looking at conflict. We watch movies with conflict, books or shows with conflict, because we're seeing, examples of how we can eventually break through our own conflict. Because if we don't have conflict, we don't have friction in our life, we can't grow. So just like a seed has to break through the soil to get to the light, that's friction. That's conflict.
Yep.
That's they have to actually kind of crack through in order to get the light, which will then make them grow and grow and grow. So that's an analogy I just came out of my butt with. But I'm
it was good, man.
It actually sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Like I want to see the image of like the tree growing through the sidewalk and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, I think we want to watch it because it is that idea of that we learn. So I write and have written a number of young adult novels, and people always say, oh, I worry about kids reading about sex or violence or these various things. And it's like, well, they're not necessarily going to do it. I don't think that's the way it is. You read that because you want to see how someone else navigated that conflict, right? So if, you know, your conflict was you were going to, you know, do a hike through someplace, the smart person says to somebody like, well, what did you wear? What kind of hiking boots? Do you have a map? What did you bring with you? You want a kind of guide to get through that. And I think observing other people in conflict automatically gives us that chance to say, you know, what would I do? Which is kind of what we're trying to do in film or in any kind of story, is let the reader or the viewer experience it, but in a safe way, right? So we all want to imagine that we'd, you know, storm the Bastille and we'd be, you know, the ones to do that. I do a lot of presentations with kids and I say, like, let's be honest. Like, if you were living out the Hunger Games and somebody pulled your sibling's name out of the hat, like, how many of you would be like, no, choose I volunteer as a tribute, versus being like, oh man,
that's a shame. I like
that. That's a shame. Can I have your room? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, we're not likely. We want to see other people do those big and glorious things and fight back against conflict, because it kind of gives us the feeling like, maybe if I was then under the wire, I'd know how to do it.
So in a lot of ways, you know, I always talk about being inside your comfort zone and being inside that comfortable place. And if you're comfortable is kind of the worst place to be, if you ever want some sort of evolution or growth. It truly is.
Yeah.
Like if you're like making $150K a year, living in Kansas somewhere, has a nice house, you're not really trying to rock the boat at that point. You're like, you're not trying to grow as a person or trying to, you know, put more tools in the toolbox to move to another place in your life. You're good. But when the fit hits the shan, when the fit hits the shan and you're at a place where you have to move because it's getting so bad that if you don't move, then you're going to die or some sort of version of death in your world. That's what drives you to move. So that comfort zone is a dangerous place. And I think a lot of us fall into that comfort zone so many times. I think that's why when you see conflict on the screen, it's just like, it just draws you in because you just want to get through it a little bit.
Well, and I think I give the example a lot when I talk to people around, if people are going to make a change, it's because of one of two reasons. And they're either going to get pushed or they're going to get pulled. And to kind of understand that example, I say, I want you to imagine that we're going to take a field trip to New York City, and I'm going to take you to Simon Schuster, which is in Rockefeller Plaza, right there on Avenue of the Americas. So we're going to go way up. There's a nice little rooftop deck up there, right? So I forget what it is. We're going to say 110 stories. You're way the heck up there, right? Like, everything's teeny tiny down on that ground, right? And I say to you, like, you know what's really interesting? In one corner of this building, which is in fact true, the other building is only about 5.5 feet away.
Oh, God, I just got chills.
And I could say to you, like, Alex, you know, you look reasonably fit. I bet if you had a good run and start, you could make that jump. Now, assuming that you're remotely sane, you'd be like, no, like, I'm not going to do that.
What's behind me?
But if I say to you, like, regretfully, this building is on fire and the flames have already come up the stairwells, there's absolutely no way down. It's too windy for a helicopter to push, you know, basically lift us off. The ladders don't go up this high. You either need to jump or you're going to burn here. Most people will try and make that jump.
Well, there's
right?
because there's no choice because it's
you can just sit down burn. And there are people who do there, right. Like, there are people who are like, well,
this is my time.
This is it.
This is my time. But it's either you choose to die or you take the chance, the hope, and that you're going to survive. But the worst that happens if you don't make it is you die as well. So either way, you're going to die either a fiery death or plummet to your death. Yeah. So it's up to you how you feel about both.
Which way do you want to go? Now, the other way that I can get you off that rooftop is if I put something on the other rooftop that is so compelling that you feel the need to do it. So if I said to someone, let's assume that Simon & Schuster becomes the Hunger Games of publishing, right? And they say, there's a million.
Isn't it already kind of?
So if I say to you, there's $1 million book contract on that other roof, and whoever's willing to jump over there and get it can have it. Now, there'll probably be a lot more people who are like, no, it's not worth it. But I know a few writers who I'm pretty sure would be like, you know, I took track in high school. Like, I bet I could do this. So they will try. And you can see that in books. So, you know, we're laughing and joking, but zombie books are the great example where people will push through and do things because there's something behind them. They're being pushed to try things. Romance stories are almost always about pull, right? It's the idea that, wow, I could have this person in my life, or I could be this place if I wanted to do that, and it will pull them forward. But you need a push or a pull for people to change, because otherwise, why wouldn't you stay safe on the rooftop? That's human nature. We evolve not to do things that are difficult. We don't seek out friction typically.
And that's the thing is like, but if you don't, I know people who've never looked for friction, and they live in the comfort zone their entire life, and they had one goal, and that's the goal that they wanted. And once they got that goal, I'm like, I'm coasting until this is over. I don't want any shifts at all in my boat. I just want a smooth sail. I know a person like that specifically. I'm thinking about right now, and they're happy though. At least they externally they seem happy. What happens, you know, like maybe I should have written that book. Maybe I should have traveled more. Maybe I should have done this. But, you know, it's really interesting. But there are people like that in the world. But generally speaking, though, even in the comfort zone, you do eventually just, like you said, get bored.
Usually you will. But certainly without a doubt, like and this is always, again, the difference between real life and any kind of fiction. There are a lot of people who will coast. Now, am I going to go watch a 2-hour film of a guy who coasts?
No, it's because I'm
like, oh, we're an hour and a half in, and he's come back home and sat back down. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Like, we're only going to watch that movie to see that person thrown out of that space. So you're going to have to make them uncomfortable to keep my interest. Now, they may not be seeking that out. So again, we may take your guy who's in the nice, comfortable place, and all of a sudden, I'm going to have, oh, I don't know, something crazy, like a global pandemic that's going to suddenly take out, you know, certain things where all of a sudden he can't do what he did before. And he's going to have to do something different. Now I'm interested. Now I'm watching.
Right. Yeah. Someone knocks on the door. I'm like, I'm your son.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden his entire world is thrown upside down.
Boom.
And yeah. Overnight. And then it happened. You can see those kind of techniques used in so many stories and so many movies. Someone's just, it's the whole Joseph Campbell. It's the ordinary world.
Yeah. You know? And look, real people like to be safe, right? There are people who seek out challenges, and, you know, you can argue they have more exciting, more fulfilling lives because they put themselves through that friction. Mm-hmm. You can argue that, you know, they're crazy, that they should just stay, you know, I feel like we're slamming Kansas and I'm going to end up having some like
Wyoming.
People who are like, love Kansas.
Wyoming.
I'm sure it's beautiful. Somehow they hate you. So that's great.
Wyoming, South Dakota, California, wherever, any state you like.
Yeah. Like, you know, if you stay in that place, they're happy, they're good with that. But again, in fiction, what I'm paying to see, and it's important to remember that we're asking people to pay for a product, is we want to see someone go through a struggle. We want to see them overcome that, or, you know, if you're wanting to see a tragedy, then you're going to watch them, you know, fail. But I think one of the problems is that sometimes as writers, we don't like conflict in our own lives, and we go easy on our characters, and that's a mistake.
So a lot of the things, a lot of these examples we've been talking about, it's been external conflict, which is the push and the pull, which were like external fire coming in, you know, or the $1 million is an external pull. What are some examples of internal conflict?
So there's a great book by Donald Moss, who's a literary agent, and he wrote a book called Writing the Breakout Novel. And he has an exercise in there where he says, tell me what it is that your character wants more than anything. And then write down what the opposite of that thing is. And then figure out how your character wants both of those things. And initially I was like, well, that's crazy, right? But let's just take it at a very basic thing. Like if you say, you know what, I want to be fitter. Okay. I want to, you know, lose some weight, you know, get some better cardio going, all that kind of stuff. External conflicts are rarely the thing that get in your way with that, right? Like we all kind of know like, oh, I should probably eat a little bit healthier. I need to, you know, get out, move more. I need to do these kinds of things. That's what I need to do. What gets in your way is the internal thing, which is that you also want to sit on your butt and watch Netflix. And sometimes you want both of those things at the same time, right? You want the cookie.
I want right? the cookie, but I also want the rock. I want six pack.
Yeah. You know, and the problem is that you cannot have those things at the same time. You want to be the partner in your law firm and you want to spend more time with your family. So it's often not the external stuff. It's that internally you're fighting between yourself because you want both things. So you want to be a fighter.
So let's use an example from a movie. Is there a character in a movie that had, you know, a classic character in a movie that you can think of that has internal conflict, that has those two opposite things? Like, I mean, I'm thinking, I always go to Star Wars because it's like the most, you know, it's very well known. Like Darth, like Luke. Luke wants to travel. He wants to break out of his little, you know, farm and become, but I don't know what the other, like the opposite.
Opposite is being safe, right? Like he wants to keep his butt in peace.
I want to be safe, but I also want to be a starfighter.
Yeah, right. Like I mean, even look, like he has the classic call to adventure, which is a literal call, right? Hey, you know, you want to go with me? We're going to, you know, save the princess, all this kind of stuff. And he's like, I can't. And he says he can't because he has to stay and be a moisture farmer. Like, let's just have a moment where we say,
moisture farmer. George, moisture farmer. I love it.
Moisture farming. That's what he's doing. Like, really, when you ask me, I think I'd pretty much rather do anything than be a moisture farmer. But, you know, at the moment when he's asked, it's like, well, he still wants to be safe. He doesn't want to rock the boat. He doesn't want to do any of those things. He doesn't want to turn off the guidance system and use the force because everyone around him, I mean, I just love imagining that you're the head of the rebel forces. You're facing down the biggest thing. It's called the Death Star. Like, it's not exactly subtle, right? Like, it's a bad thing, right? It's called the Death Star. It can blow up planets. You are throwing everything that you have at it. This is a one, like, if you don't take this thing out, the rebellion is done. The universe is done. And everybody gets taken out except the kid who was a moisture farmer an hour and a half ago, who, you know, is basically saying, yeah, I never, you know, piloted a starship before, but I used to have a land cruiser, and it's kind of like shooting those womp rats, right? It's like, no, dude, it's nothing. It's nothing like that, right?
It's nothing like the womp rat.
No. You're not going to put somebody in a stealth fighter who, like, I used to have a 4V, like, you know? I used to shoot squirrels. It's just like that, right? And it's like, this guy's like, you know what I'll do is I'll take the only decent thing we have, which is the guidance system, and I'll turn it off.
Right, exactly. So that's actually a pretty good example, because you're right. He does want both things. And then you go to the opposite, Darth Vader, you know, in his arc, he wants to be, you know, the bad Darth Vader guy, but he also wants to connect with his son.
Right.
So there's that, those opposites. So I've never really thought about conflict, internal conflict like that before, because if you start analyzing all these kind of amazing characters over the course of cinema, many of them, will, if you start analyzing, they want two things, and they're generally on the opposite, which is what makes them interesting. That's why a villain that, you know, he literally just early on, like, twists his mustache as, you know, like, woohoo, you know, and he's like, you know, he's got the girl on the train tracks, and the train's coming, and like, I'm evil just to be evil. They're very boring, very, very boring villains. But then you got someone like Thanos, I'll use from more current, who's a complex villain, because he wants to actually, he kind of wants to save the universe and help the universe. But the way he's doing it is a little off.
That's a matter of perspective, right? Like, but, that's but what we're talking about here.
But there's an interest.
There's an interest, and I think it's just important to remember that external conflict is a matter of problem solving, right? So if you have to get through, you know, this obstacle course, you know, and you have to do it in order to defuse the bomb. And that's what I've set up for you that you have to do. And so you're going to have to figure out, you know, all these little puzzles in order to get through that. That's just an exercise in problem solving. And most people, you know, if we set it up, they should be able to hopefully get through those things. The real friction comes internally, which is what's getting between you and them to solve that problem, right? So I think it, I mean, I, this is why I'm not personally in law enforcement for a whole host of reasons. But running towards data, part of what law enforcement is about, right? So if someone's shooting, you think, oh, I'm going to run closer to that. My internal thing is like, no,
I'm out.
You're on your own. No, sorry. So what is it inside yourself? So is it a desire for safety, which is often a very fair thing that would keep you from wanting to have adventures? Is it feeling guilty about leaving people behind? Is it, you know, what is it that's kind of inside of you that you may not even be aware of?
So there's the, obviously the greatest Christmas movie of all time, Die Hard. I mean, it's just
a long fact. May it rain. Yes.
It's obviously a fact. We've done many podcasts about this.
Yeah. I'm not going to argue. No.
So Die Hard is a perfect example of really insane external conflict. You know, which is he's constantly being pushed throughout that movie by the bad guys, by Hans and by all the terrorists and trying to save people. But if you take away the internal conflict that he has, which is now he's going through his divorce or breakup with his wife, and now his wife has been put in jeopardy. So like he wants to save her. But like, so what's his internal, I'd just love to hear your point of view. His internal conflict with her is that he wants to keep that relationship going, and she doesn't. So there's that kind of friction. But yet now he has to go save her as well. So what's the intern in your opinion?
And I think it's the two parts of it. So I think there's one part of it, which is part of what he wants to do is obviously beat Hans Gruber, because he's a cop, and that's what you do. But part of him also, like, he could probably sneak in, grab his wife, and get her out of there.
Right. You're right. I mean, right? Like, comfortably, before anyone knew who she was or anything, he could have probably just come in, boom, and get... But then that... Well, first of all, that's a horrible movie.
Yeah. In case someone's like, I never thought of that, right?
That's not who that character
who he is.
Right.
So he's you know, having to juggle both of wanting to save his wife... but wanting to save everyone else and to be true to who he is, which is partly what caused the friction in his marriage, is that he put so much time and effort into being a cop. And she felt there was never any time for her. And he also has to learn to trust her, right? Because at the end, she's the one who is truly able to help him. And he's not someone who trusts other people. So he has to trust the guy outside. Right. Who's going to, you know, help him. And he has to learn to trust his wife in order to really defeat Hans Gruber. He wouldn't have been able to do it 100% on his own.
Very cool. Now, we've been talking a little bit about conflict in regards to story and characters. How should you, or can you discuss I guess we have been discussing the main difference between the conflict of a story and the conflict of characters. But how should characters respond to conflict?
Oh, I think this is fun because you get to have some decisions about this because people respond in sort of all different sorts of way to conflict, right? So I think we tend to think of the two most basic, which is fight or flight, mm-hmm. right? So if we look at it again, like, and I'm coming at this from sort of a psychological point of view, in the animal kingdom, you don't get, for example, a bunny rabbit who's like, oh yeah, Mr. Coyote, bring it. Like, do you know what I mean? Like the rabbit will run.
Period.
That's it. Evolutionarily speaking, the rabbit understands it's outgunned and it will choose survival, right? You have to be a little higher up the food chain to choose fight because you're choosing fight if you feel like you have a pretty good chance to win. Or you have no choice, right? So again, this is where you see someone who, yeah, like the bunny will come out, you know, paws a flapping or whatever you want to call it, you know, the
buck teeth,
ears
buck
spinning.
Buck teeth ready to go.
Yeah.
If he's cornered because that there's no choice for him. It's either fight or you're going to die. So you might as well fight.
Yeah. So you can think in terms of, you know, where's your character at and, you know, what would they choose to do, right? And they're not going to necessarily choose to fight right away. So you might have them trying to kind of avoid conflict or get around conflict until they can't avoid it anymore. But there are also a couple other options that people don't think about. So one of them is freeze, which is a lot of times in the face of danger, you will just... freeze, right? So the obvious example is animals do this.
Goats. the freezing. Everyone listening right now, go to YouTube after this interview and type in goat scare, and you'll be laughing for quite some time. But when I first saw it, I couldn't believe, and it was just that one goat. Like basically, you just scare a goat, and there was a herd of them, and they all froze at the same time and just dropped to the floor on their side, frozen. And I couldn't stop laughing. It is so brilliant. But yes, they do that.
Well, and also, how do you get away from a T-Rex? Everybody knows this if you've seen Jurassic Park. They tell you don't move, don't do anything, because they, right? So animals, evolutionary, sometimes learn like, well, if I can't run, maybe I'll just freeze solid for a second and hope it didn't see me. And people do this. You've been in situations where you'll see a guy in the living room or whatever, and his wife comes in and she slams the door in the kitchen and he'll just go totally silent, right? Like, maybe if I just sit here, one of the kids will find her, right? Like,
and they'll take the brunt.
Yeah. How can I, like, just not be seen? Like, they're doing a goat, right? They're just freezing right where they are and hoping it passes by.
Right.
So that's another response that your character can have, is they can sort of hope that it passes by them. And the other is fawn, which is a nice way of saying kissing up, right? So, and you certainly know people who do this, who will throw someone else under the bus. I don't know, try and think of, I don't know, some politicians or something who may have
sacrificed another politician or a coworker in corporate America. That happens constantly.
You know, like where they're just going to, they're going to kiss up to the bad guy because I'd rather be on the bad guy's side than not.
Oh, it's like in Die Hard, that guy,
Let's work in
steel. Hans, baby, I can help you, Hans. Yeah, the cocaine guy. I forgot his name, but the most perfectly cast guy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, so perfectly cast, that guy. But yes, so similar to that.
You know, he's gonna kiss up and he's like, I'm going to get on these guys' side. I'm going to do that. You will see, you know, again, if we take the same, you know, wife who's come home really angry, you know, one option might be to go out there and be like, oh, you look so beautiful today. Let me rub your shoulders. You know, let's distract you by being really kind and effusive kind of thing. So there are different ways that, yeah, smart people have a way of dealing with conflict, and you want to have a range of tools at your thing. And I think when you're writing characters is to sit down and figure out how would my character respond in this moment? And kind of running through the four different options can give you some different ways of looking at it. Like what happens if they freeze? Is it possible that someone will be distracted? Again, you can think of all sorts of scenes in Walking Dead where that's basically what they're doing. Like just don't move, don't make a sound. You know, you throw a rock, you're trying to basically put it onto something else. It's kind of hard to really fawn over a zombie, though I guess if you smear yourself with other things so you smell like them, they feel like they're one of the crowd, I guess would be the best example of fawning in that. But certainly, you know, there was a lot of things in Walking Dead of people sort of kissing up to people who were taking power. So it's like, well, if this is the seat of power, then I want to be close to it. And I'm not going to fight it because that's going to be hard. Fight is hard. Yeah, that's what writers remember.
And no one ever kisses up in Hollywood. That's not something that happens here in LA. So
publishing them, I guess.
I have no understanding. I have no understanding what you're talking about. It's so funny. Like when you see, you know, I've been a director for 20 odd years now. And you know, when you're on set, I can see like those new people coming on set who try to get closer to the director, because there's that perceived power on the set. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating to watch how people act. But yeah, it's just, that's almost instinctual at this point. It's almost evolutionary.
If you look at a wolf pack, basically, you know, there's one who's the alpha. So we're going to make the director the alpha. So you can kind of see yourself now as alpha wolf, right? Sure. So yeah, why not? Enjoy it while it lasts, right? Sure. And then, you know, what you have is a group of other wolves who are either going to work with that. They're going to roll over and show their belly, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to find a pecking order. They're going to, you know, work towards that one wolf, or they're going to have to strike out on their own. And that is risky and dangerous. A wolf on their own is much more likely to get injured. If it does get injured, it's much more likely to die. So again, when we think of characters who are, you know, doing a Bruce Willis diet, like, that's some risky stuff, right? And you have to really push someone to do that kind of thing.
Now, should you, you know, what should you focus on more? Should you focus on the story's conflict or the characters or the character's conflict?
Can I have both?
Again, from the beginning, like having both. All right, so when you're constructing a story, do you construct the internal first or the external first?
I think actually this is a writer choice. Because I think there are stories that come to us in different ways, right? So you come up with a story idea, and either sometimes you'll hear, particularly, you know, people who are doing novels will say, I'm either doing a plot-driven story or I'm doing a character-driven story. So sometimes they have a character and it's like, I really want to write about this person. And then you're trying to figure out what's the situation that would most kind of push that character or, you know, evolve them into a different place. Or you've come up with a great concept in terms of like, I have this great thing, like now who's the best person to put into that story to really stretch it and make it seem interesting. So I think you can tackle it either way. But the fun thing is to then see how those things are going to interact with each other. So how, as my internal conflict that I'm dealing with, how is that going to make dealing with the external conflict maybe harder? Is there something that if I can resolve my internal conflict, that's what I need to do to solve my external conflict? I think some of that is when you think of, I think it's John Truby who talks about want versus need, if I'm remembering correctly. So yeah, like if you think of, you know, the external being the want or the external conflict, that often they need to resolve the internal conflict in order to beat that external.
Yeah, so in regards to plot versus character, I always find it fascinating because a lot of people say, oh, I'm going to write I'm a plot-driven writer as opposed to a character-driven. But if you look at films over the years, you don't generally remember plots. You remember characters. Like, I can vaguely tell you, like, the plots of Indiana Jones. I mean, probably the first one because I've seen it more. But other than that, you know, they're vague. It's not the memorable thing. You know, when you watch Last Crusade, the memorable thing is his dad and him, the conflict between those two. That's what drives that story. I think out of plot, like Sixth Sense is probably one plot that I kind of remember. And even then, I just basically remember the ending, you know, so that was the thing that kind of stuck to you. So you don't really stick, you know, I think for successful storytelling, and you tell me, you know, character has to be, you know, plots are obviously important, but people remember character much more than they remember.
Well, and it because part of it is where character meets plot, right? So if you have a scene or a plot, like this is a story about a bank robbery gone wrong where they hold a bunch of people hostage in the bank and they're trying to get out. So that's your plot, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's who you put in that becomes interesting.
Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah, like all of a sudden it's who's in that story that becomes the catalyst for that. Like, because you can do Dog Day Afternoon, or you can say, okay, it's a nursery school teacher who's pushed to her limit, who has no skills in this area at all. And so she's going to have to be the one that, you know, comes through this, right? Like how that person deals with it becomes often what is interesting to us. So it's people meeting plot. And that's what we find kind of enjoyable, is to see how are they going to cope and deal with that. Like, I think some of the bad, in my humble opinion, James Bond movies is where, where they lost track of him as a character, and they were just like, what's the most outrageous situation we can put this super spy into? And so they came up with, you know, more and more bigger and better kinds of things. But if you look at the ones that are tend to be people's favorites, is where he's pushed personally as a character. So the situation, the plot is still big. There's still things happening. But what's interesting is he going to choose to save the woman that he's finally felt like he could start to love, or hold on to his duty? Those become the things that we follow and that we're interested in.
So exactly. I mean, because I think James Bond, I mean, I was a fan of the old ones, the Pierce Brosnan and Sean Connery's, and they were fun to watch. But when Craig came in, his run, especially Casino Royale, which I still consider probably the best Bond, one of the best Bonds, and that in Skyfall, it was just so dense because you actually first finally got into who Bond is. You made him vulnerable. He wasn't a superhero. That's why it's so difficult to write for Superman, because he's Superman.
Superman.
It's rough. I mean, they throw the kryptonite in, but it gets boring after a while. You know, it's like, so it's very difficult to write. But that's why Batman's so much more interesting, because he's so much more vulnerable. There's so many more ways he can have, and talk about internal conflict. Jesus. I mean,
he needs a therapist real bad. He's dressed in that Batcave is sadly missing a therapist. He would do well to work some of that out. But yeah, I mean, I think Superman is, I think, a great example in that, you know, yeah, interesting character, but I don't know if much has been made of, like, where is he vulnerable? Where are the push points of him? Because that, I think, again, is what we like seeing as viewers, is how does this particular person, with their strengths, with their weaknesses, solve the problem? Will Han Solo go back to help, which is against his nature, right? Or is he going to, you know, reach out and find some connection in this moment? Those are the kinds of things that we remember and provide us with that cheering moment, right? Like, that's what you're looking for, is where people are like, yes, right? They got up. They did it again after we didn't think they would do it. We're looking for that. And that's people meeting story.
Now, when you are building characters, can you just discuss a little bit about what emotional intelligence is?
I would love to. So Emotional intelligence is interesting because it comes from, in my opinion, the very best thesis question that was ever asked, which is, why is it that smart people do stupid things? Which, when you think about it, is brilliant because we all know someone who is quite smart, but possibly not successful. But until there was a theorist, Ravon Baron, who is out of Israel, basically said, well, look, we know how to measure intelligence. There are several tests. There's the WAIS and the Wechsler and so forth, where we can test intelligence. So I can give you a test and say you're in the genius IQ or you're not. But it doesn't seem to be correlated to success, which logic tells us it should be. The smartest people should, in theory, be the most successful people. But that has certainly not helped.
Not held up at all.
So he started saying, well, there has to be something else, some other kind of quality. And the term emotional intelligence came up. And so it's 15 different components that look at things like reality testing. How good are you at understanding that what you see is not necessarily objective and is influenced by what's going on around you or your own personal perspective? How well are you aware of your own emotions? That's another kind of thing. So he was looking at that ability to understand that, oh, other people have other emotions. If you want a great example, again, remember back when we could travel.
Yes, it was a fun time.
It was a fun time. I remember I was headed on a flight someplace, and basically the flight got canceled. And so now we're all in this huge lineup, all desperately seeking to get on another flight, right?
And conflict.
And the guy in front of me is tearing a strip off this airline worker with, like, do you know who I am? Oh. And I need to be back for this. And I'm a very important person. And I have so many miles on this airline. And I, you know. And so she says, you know, we're doing the best we can, et cetera, et cetera. And then I went up next and I said something like, oh, I'm so sorry that you're having this horrible day. And I sort of commiserated about working in customer service and said, this is, you know, I'm actually trying to get back. It's my grandmother's 90th birthday, which was, you know, this kind of thing. She said, okay, well, you have to wait. Well, if you want to guess who got on the next flight, it would be me.
With a first grade upgrade. First class upgrade.
No, I'm joking. You know, so... It's that idea of that's emotional intelligence. It's the idea that yelling at this customer service worker is not necessarily going to get me what I want.
Right. So like perfect. You're absolutely right. So that concept of being the smartest, because there are people who are, you know, high level geniuses, but generally can't even work within society because they just don't have a high emotional IQ. They have a great intelligence, but not an emotional IQ. And adding that into your character is really interesting to kind of start thinking about that, because someone like Rain Man, you know, Dustin Hoffman's Rain Man, perfect example. Him and Tom Cruise. So let's just, if we can analyze the emotional intelligence of both of those guys. So obviously Rain Man, IQ was off the chart, and he had intelligence beyond intelligence. I mean, he was almost just basically a computer. He didn't know how to apply that information very well. But then you had Tom Cruise's character, I forgot his name, but Tom Cruise's character, who was all emotional intelligence. He knew how to hustle. He knew how to work the system. He knew how to, you know, but couldn't even come to close to the intelligence or the capabilities of his brother. And one was very successful and one was sitting in a room somewhere watching, what was it, Wheel of Fortune or?
People's Court.
People's Court. Thank you.
Time for Wapner. Time for Wapner.
Yeah, Kmart sucks. So that's a really, you know, really a good example of adding emotional intelligence to your character. So someone like
and Indiana it gives you a chance to sort of play, because we all have areas that we're better or weaker in, right? Sure. You know, we're not all perfectly evolved, but the good news is that emotional intelligence typically can grow, right? You can become more emotionally intelligent. Whereas tragically, I hate to inform you, like your IQ doesn't grow. You may become more knowledgeable, so you can learn new things, but you can't become more intelligent.
Like, I'm not going to become a rocket scientist because I read a lot of rocket scientist books. I might be able to read it, but my mind is not built that way. Personally, like, I can't. Yeah. I'm not a science math dude. That's not where I am.
Yeah, no, yeah, me either.
But on the creative, on the marketing, on the artistic side, my intelligence is a lot higher than in math. That's why my wife does the math, and I don't. Anytime she tries to. She understood that years ago. Finally, she figured it out. She's like, why aren't you doing your own books? I'm like, You don't want to know.
I once did a budget for a healthcare thing where I taped a penny to the form because I could not figure out where it was. Right? So there are, you know, there's intelligence that you have and there's just certain places. But your emotional intelligence, you can grow. And there are tons of, and this is another piece of advice I would give to writers, is check out your local self-help section. Of a bookstore.
Yes.
Because there are so, whatever your character is struggling with, I guarantee you there's a self-help book on that topic, which will give you lots of ideas to dig into. But there are a lot of great books on emotional intelligence. There are a lot of online tests that you can give yourselves that are kind of give you some ideas of where you're strong. So, you know, answer them from your character's point of view and figure out, like, is there some place where they're weak in emotional intelligence and they have to grow in that area. So going back to Rain Man and Tom Cruise is really good at figuring out other people's emotions, right? Like he can figure out what people need and then how to manipulate them. Right. He's really good at, you know, all kinds of things, but one of the things he's not good at is his own emotions, right? Like he doesn't cope with those and he can't deal with how he feels about his brother for a lot. And that's actually what he has to. And when he does that is when he becomes a more complete person. So you can kind of push. And again, there's whole books like, oh, you want to get better at this aspect of emotional intelligence? Well, here's things you can do. So you can look and figure out like, okay, is there something that I can give a task, something that can be happening to my character that's pushing them to grow in that particular zone?
Right. And someone like Sherlock Holmes, for instance, he didn't have very much emotional intelligence, if I remember the classic, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah, the classic. Oh.
he was pretty just kind of like he was much more on the intelligence side. And he actually was very awkward in social environments. He just was so beyond everybody else in the room. He was so much smarter that he was difficult. I mean, I would not want to deal with a human being like that. And I have dealt with certain people that are that kind of level of intelligence, and it's really difficult. And they look at me like I'm an oddity because I'm like, because I'm able to function very comfortably in a social environment and an artistic and very abstract place. I live in the abstract where he lives in a, it's concrete, one plus one equals two, but I say one plus one is the beginning of the conversation.
Let's get locked down into two, right? I mean, there is a lot of science that's gone into emotional intelligence that says, obviously, you need a base level of basic IQ.
Yes.
But assuming that someone has a good basic level of IQ, the stronger they are with the emotional intelligence, the more likely they are to be successful. Because the more likely they are to be able to interact with people, be able to change how they interact depending with who they're dealing with, the more likely they are to understand like, oh, I see this situation this way, but it's possible I'm not seeing it accurately. There might be a different perspective here. Those are all aspects of emotional intelligence. So they're good to have, and they're fun to play with a character.
I wanted to get your opinion on this because I actually, in the book I wrote was based on my time making a movie for the mafia. That's a whole other conversation. So I got to deal with at a young age, I was dealing with these kind of characters, which were real, and I was interacting with them. That, you know, a mobster, let's say, there's a gangster. They have fairly decent emotional intelligence in the sense of how to manipulate people, how to read the room, how to move things around. Their core intelligence, they're essentially many of them, and any mobsters listening, it's not all mobsters I'm talking about.
But and certainly not you, Mr. Mobster.
Certainly not you, Mr. Mobster, who's listening. But if you look at Goodfellas and stuff, they're not bright. They're not super intelligent. They're blunt instruments. But they know how to work within their group and within their society emotionally. Because I guess Don Corleone, you know, as a gangster or a mobster, Michael was probably one of the more intelligent mobsters in cinema history, essentially.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, there's that book smart, and there's when rubber smart. Meets the road smart, right?
Right.
Those are two different kinds of smarts. And in emotional intelligence, obviously, can be used and can be manipulated, right? Some of the arguments is that, you know, some aspects of emotional intelligence, you know, people who are sociopathic are some of the stronger in those areas, but not in others. So just right. for clarity, there are others that they will be weak in. But the more that you understand your own emotions, how they make you feel, a lot of people confuse their emotions. Like I would argue a lot of mobsters, and again, not you, Mr. Mobster, I'm sure you're very in touch with your emotional side. But they will confuse things like, and you know, this is not necessarily a guy thing in general, but it's not uncommon that a guy will confuse fear and anger. So if someone is emotionally upset or scared, they will lash out. So I used to work in the hospital system when I was working as a counselor. So I worked with people with catastrophic injuries or illness. And the first thing that you learn is that you get yelled at a lot. And it's because people are scared. Right. So you have your loved one who's in a surgery, you know, you're not sure if they're going to come out, and someone will start screaming at you about how the hospital cafeteria was supposed to have chocolate chip cookies and instead they have oatmeal raisins, and raisins are lousy and no one likes raisins. And, you know, they'll be screaming, and it's, you have to know, like, they're not actually mad. They're scared. They're really, really scared. And they cannot identify their own emotion.
And that's something really interesting in a character. If you can write that into a character, that makes that character much more interesting. Because you're right. A lot of times it's not about the raisins.
It's generally not
about the raisins. It's generally something deeper. So it's just trying to create those kind of layers to your character.
Well, and I will talk about placeholder conflict with people, where I say it's what the conflict means to me versus necessarily what it is. So a common married conflict and I'm divorced, so this may say so many things, right? But like someone who will leave their sock nuggets, their little sock balls, you know, when they rip them off the bottom of their feet, and they leave them right next to the hamper, like... not in the hamper, which is open and available to receive dirty laundry.
Fairly large.
Large, oh, ample.
Much ample, much larger than a basketball net.
Yes, this is a copious, like there is space for that sock, right? And they will take it off and they'll just leave it laying there like this sad origami
my daughters,
nugget.
My daughters.
Right?
Yes.
If someone is yelling at you about that, it's usually not about the effort that it takes to pick up the sock and put it in the hamper. It's about, I feel like you think this is my job. Do you think I'm the maid? You you don't care about our space. Because if you cared about our space, you would want it to look nice. You wouldn't leave your socks out. You wouldn't put a dish by the sink instead of in the dishwasher. Where to the other person, it's like, they just don't care, right? Like socks on the floor is just like, well, I might want to wear it again tomorrow. Like I'm just leaving it where it's comfortably accessible to me.
And speaking from someone who's been married now for quite some time, I find that guys are, it's just a sock. It's at the end of the day, it's just a sock. I'm sorry. But on the other side of the fence, they're much more about, it means so everything you just said.
Yes, this is where men are like, this is suddenly a marriage help, self-help thing. Dudes, it's not about the sock.
It isn't. Right? I learned that a long time ago.
So not about the sock. Sock is a placeholder for something else. So sometimes asking yourself, you know, what is it that your character is really angry about? And they may not be able to articulate it. Like they may say, it's about the fact that I've asked 5,000 times to throw the sock in the hamper and they just don't do it. So he's not listening to me. Right. But if you really dig down, like, does it matter if the sock is on the floor? It's like, well, yeah, it matters to me because of this. And, you know, my idea of what it means to be a wife or what our house should look like.
It just turns into a whole.
The division of labor, all of this kind of stuff,
it goes,
right?
It goes off the tracks.
I don't feel like I'm a feminist now because I picked up his socks and now I've let down womanhood, right? So there's a lot that is in that sock.
And for guys,
you're still like, it's a sock,
it's a sock,
right?
I'm sorry. I didn't know. It was just a sock. I'll put the sock in the, in, I'm sorry.
Well, and then it becomes a placeholder conflict because it's like, she won't let up about the sock. Like there's all this other stuff going on and she's going to pick on me about this stuff. And then it gets into, now I feel like you're acting like my mom and you're saying that I can't be a man and put my socks where I want to put my socks. Like I work 80 hours a week. I'm going to put my socks. I want to put my dang socks. You're not the mom of me. Right. So all of a sudden you're fighting about stuff. It's so not the sock.
It's not.
When you're writing scenes, think about that stuff. Right. Like spend some time and ask yourself, like, what can I have them fighting about? And then what is it really about? What is that a placeholder for?
Yes. Without question. Well, let me ask you real quick. Do you write backstories on your characters?
Oh, yes. I wrote a whole book on writing story, in fact.
Okay. So then that's a hard yes.
That's a hard yes.
Because I know a lot of people, when they write, they just write that kind of, you know, when they're writing a character, they just kind of do a little bit of research on them or they kind of develop a small little backstory on it. But then I've heard, who was I talking to? Oh, no, I was watching the Schitt's Creek documentary. Because I just finished watching all of Schitt's Creek, by the way, one of the greatest shows ever. And they were talking about
Canadian.
it is Canadian. It is a Canadian show. I'm sorry. But then there was, I think it was Eugene Levy, when his son came in to start writing with him, Eugene Levy just kept pounding him. I'm like, no, we're going to write a book on each of these characters. So like, and that's where a lot of their strong. All of his work throughout his life with Best of Show and the stuff he did with Christopher Guest, all those characters are so rich and so deep. It's because they just spent weeks just writing backstory that will never see the screen, but you can just sense it. So what's your advice on creating backstory?
Well, first off, I want to talk about why I think it's so important. So again, I'm putting my counseling hat back on, which is who we are is an accumulation of all the things that have happened to us. And then the story that we tell ourselves about what happened to us, right? So we tell ourselves a story to make sense of what happened. So you could be adopted and tell yourself the story that I was never wanted. And then how you go through the rest of your life, the choices they make, the relationships you have will be based on that story that you tell yourself, which is I am someone that people don't want. You could be adopted and say to yourself, I'm so good that unlike you who just came shooting out of your mother, my mother chose me. She chose to adopt me. She went through effort and all this stuff to have me. And then that is going to shape who you are. Michael Haig, who's a screenwriter, talks about what's the hole in your character's soul, which is fun to say if you've been drinking. Which is, you know, what happened to them that sort of shapes who they are. So the easiest way to get about this that I think, which is a tool that I used with real people, but I do with imaginary characters, is just a basic timeline. So you're going to draw a dot on one side of the page and you're going to say birth. And then you're going to draw a dot on the other side of the page and you're going to say page one of your screenplay or page one of your book. And I just want you to make a timeline or what are the major events that that character had in their life between birth and when the book opens. And if it was a positive event, you list it above the line. If it was a negative event, I have people list it below the line. Then as a counselor, what I'm interested in is where do people list things and what do they see as important? So, for example, I've seen divorce listed above the line,
yeah, right,
and below the line.
Yes, and it's a story you tell. Like, I'm so happy, I'm free. Oh my God, they left me.
It was the best thing. Like, I had to grow as a person. I needed to do this. You know, this was the most important thing to happen to me. anything can be above or below the line in a lot of ways, because it is the story that you tell yourself about the event. And the example that I give, which is a real person, it was a client that I worked with, a young man, he was a roofer in his early 20s. He tripped, stumbled, and basically fell into hot tar, which is really, really bad. If you know much about burns, burns continue even after you're removed from the heat source. And of course, the problem with tar is that you can't get rid of it. Oh. Pull away from the heat source. It sticks to you. So he was in excruciating agony, so much so that he ran off the roof, snapping the safety line. He fell four stories where he was impaled on a wrought iron fence that surrounded the building site. So he had massive, and I cannot underscore, massive internal injuries, orthopedic injuries, soft tissue injuries, on top of having third degree burns over a significant part of his body, including part of his face. And I won't go into details, but burn rehab is one of the worst things to go through. Mm-hmm. And when I met him was when he was still in the burn unit. And we were doing this exercise and I was asking him, and he listed the accident above the line. And I had a moment where I left and I thought, that poor blighter's got a head injury too. Like, somebody get a neurologist consult. I think he hit his head on the way down.
Obviously, he's not right. He's not right in the head.
He's not right. And I said to him, like, I got to ask you, why would you list the accident above the line? And he said, I'm 26 years old and I now know who I can really count on in this life. Do you know how many people go their whole life and never know that?
Oh, wow. What a deep answer. What a profound answer.
And I was like, just so struck by that. And he was like, I survived. Like, what can someone do to me now? How can I be scared of public speaking when I fell off a roof and I impaled myself when I got up, right? Like, nothing. Like, who's going to stop me now, right? Like, he's like, to know that and to, like, basically have the worst thing that could ever happen and I'm going to move on. And I just remember when I left that room, it was like, this dude is going to be fine.
Yeah, like, because it's like you were saying, it's the story he told himself, because that could have been the below the line, like, my life is over. Look at me. Look what happened.
And I met, again, because I worked in the high, I met a lot of people who had really minor, what we'd call injuries. And it would be like, it's over. I can't this. I can't that. So for me, it's not what's happened to you. It's not the backstory in terms of, oh, I'm going to have that my character, survived a plane crash, or I'm going to give my character a backstory of they were raised in the foster care system. It's not what happened to them. It's what's the story they tell themselves about what happened to them that is going to change how they will react throughout your entire story.
That is profound. It's deep. Because I literally just finished watching Schitt's Creek. I binged the entire series in like a couple weeks because it's amazing. But when you see those characters, and by the way, if no one's seen it, it's on Netflix, watch it now. Those characters, the story that they tell themselves, that they're hundreds of millions of dollars, they're multimillionaires, and all their money is gone, and now they're stuck in this little town called Schitt's Creek. And they're used to hanging out with Oprah and, you know, Tiger Woods and all these other people. And now they're in a motel, and their whole life in their mind, the story that they've told themselves, this, my life is over. While people who live in the town, they're like, you're ridiculous. I've been living here all my life. I'm fine. I'm happy. Like, you're like freaking out because you don't have room services. I'm like, but it's the story they tell, because other people will look at that situation and you're like, oh, well, you know, it's only up from here, which is something that happens to those characters. They all start to
change their story, right?
At the end, they're like, I don't want to go. I don't want to leave. Sorry to, you know, spoiler alert. But generally speaking, they don't.
You didn't see that coming. Yeah.
Not to give you details. But generally, like, some of the characters just don't want to go. When given the option, even to go back to their old life, they choose, no, I like this. This is real to me. And that's also profound, like, as a character.
There's a great nonfiction book called Atomic Habits. Yes, and I can't remember.
Great book.
I can't remember who wrote it, but a really smart guy. And, you know, one of the things that he talks about is like, if you want to change the habit that you have to change your self-concept and story, right? And that's part of it as well. You have to change the backstory that you tell yourself. So if you say like, oh, I hate exercise, I hate working out, like for a while, you know, I'm no good at that kind of stuff, I'm not fit, all that kind of stuff. For a while, you can force yourself to change the action. You can make yourself get up and all that kind of stuff. But if you can find a way to change the concept of like, I'm someone who like, you know, I mean, don't like, you know, sports or whatever, but I like to move. I'm a strong person. I'm a flexible person. Then your actions will start to match that. So real people, like our characters are just reflections of real people. So you want to ask yourself, what's the story they tell themselves about what happened? So again, it's not, I think people get caught up in backstory and you see all these exercises, like what are the five things that your character always has in their refrigerator, you know, and people be like, blah, blah, blah. Like, well, I don't care, right? Unless there's something about that, right? Like what does that tell me about them in terms of how they see themselves, what's important to them? That's what's interesting because that's what's going to change what they do in other parts of their lives.
Fair enough. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions, ask all my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in writing or in life?
I think the biggest thing that I learned is that I don't actually care what the rest of you think nearly as much as I thought that I did. So part of that was the assumption that everybody else was very concerned about me and watching me and paying attention to me. And you have this realization like no one actually cared. Do you know what I mean? Like you look back at high school and it was like, oh God, like, did anyone know this? Right. And it's like, nobody was paying any attention to you at all. And then it's also occurred to me that there's a lot smaller circle of people that I care about their opinion. And so I respect their opinions and everyone else. They all have one, right? If you write a book, you can look up any book. And I always have new authors do this, look up any book or look up any film, the film where you're like, this is the best movie ever made. There'll be someone who'd be like, nah, Casablanca, didn't like it.
I always tell writers that like, oh, if you're feeling bad after a review or something like that, or filmmakers, I go, type in bad review Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
Bad review Star Wars. Bad review Godfather. Like you just, and I've read them and they're hilarious to read.
There's always someone who's not going to like it. And it's like, I can worry about that person or I can worry about the people that matter. So.
Fair enough. Now, what did you learn from your biggest failure?
That I can survive. I think, which again is one of those life lessons of you can get back up in most cases.
What was the biggest fear you ever had to overcome when writing your first anything?
I think the biggest fear was, which is a truce, which is what is on the page is never as good as what's in your head. It goes through some sort of ugly metamorphosis from like this brilliant idea in your brain to this like misshapen creature on the page. And that you have to work with that, that you have to accept that you got to fix it. It doesn't come out pretty.
There's sludge on it.
There's a lot of sludge.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Well, Shawshank Redemption would definitely be right on up there.
Lady in, after my own heart.
Also based on a great short story. So I'm going to give that a call out. Can't go wrong with that. Oh, I always watch Apollo 13. That's probably one of my, if I'm going to watch like, you know, a tried and true. And I love old class. I love the Thin Man movies.
The Sinbad movies?
The Thin Man movie.
Yeah. I remember those. Yeah.
So I love like an old classic noir kind of thing. So that would be on there as well.
Very good mix. And where can people find out more about you and the work you do?
Probably the easiest place to find me is EileenCook.com. But I'm on Twitter as Eileen Cook Writer, and I usually have an opinion on something. So you can find me there nice and easy. And if you're interested in being a writer, I'm on the Creative Academy for Writers.com. And that's an online writing group. It's free. So it doesn't cost you anything to join. We have forums for screenwriting. We have forums for all different kinds of genres and all those kinds of fun things. We have a good time.
We must have you back to talk in depth about character even more than
anytime. As you can tell, I'll just keep talking if you don't shut me up.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being on the show.
You bet. Thank you.
I want to thank Eileen for coming on the show and showing us how to create conflict with our stories and character. Thank you so much, Eileen. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get her amazing book, Creating Story Conflict, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/104. And if you haven't done it already, guys, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really, really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.